at some point over the last year or so, I kind of realized it's probably not the strategy that Tiny is going to seriously explore unless there's a crazy outside offer. And so, you know, at that point, I think just for me personally, there was just, there's other things that I'd want to work on, other projects, other investments. You know, I love Dribbble. It's like a part of my DNA at this point of like who I am, and like people know me as the Dribbble guy. And so it's a really hard decision. It's very bittersweet to make that call to step away. But, you know, the way I rationalized it too is like, hey, I was the guy to grow it to 50 million in revenue, but I'm probably not the guy to grow it to 100 million. And so let's go find that guy and I'll pass the baton.
Welcome to the Startup CEO Show. I'm your host, Mark McLeod. Since 1999, I have sat at the right hand of the CEOs of high-growth startups as either a CFO, venture capitalist, deal maker, and now coach. In that time, I've experienced massive success, complete failure, and everything in between. Join me each week as I sit down with CEOs, VCs, and other key players to hear about their startup journeys. You'll get actionable and relevant insights into how to scale your company and go all the way to a massive exit. What my guests have learned the hard way, you will get for free each week. If you're the CEO of a high-growth company, you need to make sure that you're growing faster than your business. On this podcast, you'll learn just how to do that. Let's get started. In this episode, I sit down with Zach Onisko. Zach just quit his dream job as CEO of Dribbble. Over a seven-year run, Jack led the company through 35x revenue growth and 100x EBITDA growth without raising any capital. We go into a bunch of topics in this episode, including his decision to leave his dream job, how they succeeded without raising venture capital, how to lead a company that's entirely remote from day one, and many other topics. I hope you enjoy, and if you like this, I hope you subscribe. Zach, welcome to the Startup CEO Show. It's a true pleasure to have you here today. How are you doing?
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
It's my pleasure. So I first asked you before we got on air how retirement's going, and so that's going to be my first question for you, because I reached out when I saw that you stepped down from Dribbble, which was really big news. And I thought that would be, first of all, as I thought about kind of where to take this conversation, I really saw your journey as like a study of contrasts and a going against the standard way, right? Like Dribbble was a bootstrapped company. You bought companies instead of looking to be acquired. You know, you stepped down midstream or mid, you know, whatever, not at the very end, which I know is something that people think about because the CEO job is tough. And so there's so much to learn, but I'd love to start with maybe, first of all, very long series of questions. Just tell folks what Dribbble does if they don't know. I feel like it's a household name in the design world, but maybe just tell folks what it does. And then leading to how's retirement, tell us about your decision to step down and let's just rip that apart.
Sure. Yeah, so just kickoff. So Dribbble is kind of one of the last independently owned social networks. It is a community for designers that has grown organically over the years. We turned 15 this summer. We have evolved and become multiple different things over those years from the beginning to now. But at the essence, it's a network. It's a professional network for a lot of designers, for their place to showcase their work, get feedback from peers, but also to find new work opportunities. So, you know, probably 90% of our traffic is from non-designers who are looking at the work of designers for inspiration or to find designers to hire for the next project.
As a brief aside, back when I was a VC, we led the initial funding round in Unsplash, which feels like it has some similarities just in terms of demographic, right? You know, kind of people showcasing their work, finding new work, et cetera, in one medium, which was photography, but some similarities.
Yeah, Dribbble actually acquired Crew, who was
That was the original
Unsplash.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
At the time they spun out Unsplash. So
that's right. Unsplash was not what we invested in. We invested in Mikhail and Stephanie, and initially it was Crew, and out of that came Unsplash, and kind of doubled down on that. So tell us about the decision. The decision to step down.
The decision was, you know, kind of a long time coming. In the early years of when you're signing up for a startup, it's really kind of, you know, to build enterprise value over time. And we're very successful doing that. You know, I was a hired gun CEO. So I came in right at the time that Andrew Wilkinson bought the company from the founders, or majority share of the company. And really kind of the time where Tiny wasn't even Tiny yet.
That's right. Maybe you were the inspiration for Tiny.
Yeah. I mean, I think that was kind of the kickoff of, you know, now it's become a successful holding company and with lots of companies, but
it's not so tiny.
It's not so tiny. I mean, there's 40 companies now, but at the time they had like 3 companies or 4 companies. So yeah, it's been cool to kind of see that journey, you know, and over the years, the thesis, you know, how to build the business has ebbed and flowed. I was raised in Silicon Valley. And so that wisdom was my first instinct when I took over the company was to go raise money. And that was 2017. I borrowed a little bit of capital from Tiny to just for working capital injection so I could build out the team. Cause I knew like I inherited the team as 8 people. And I'm like, okay, there's some key functions I need to fill. Give me a shareholder loan. Anyway, that was paid back in 3 or 6 months because that plan kind of worked out. But behind the scenes, I'm, you know, down on Sand Hill Road and I'm talking to all the usual suspects in the VC world and got a lot of interest. So everyone knew Dribble, but, you know, once I kind of exposed that Dribble at the time was like only doing like, you know, $2 million in revenue. And it was pretty subscale in terms of like the amount of traffic and the amount of scale. The actual website was top, you know, 2000 website in the world. So we got a lot of interest, got pretty far in some conversations and, you know, got close to term sheets where I had a bit into that year from when we took over the company in January to probably call it like October, November, our margins had expanded considerably. So during that time, I'm like doing the kind of dog and pony show, which continued to get more and more profitable. And so at kind of the end of that, I was like, well, you know, shit, what am I going to spend the money on? This is kind of an expensive check to cash. And so then I kind of backed away from that direction. And then kind of from that.
Which made them want you even more, I assume. Then they're like chasing you down.
Well, I kind of just changed tack. I just didn't pick up the phone after that, you know, so it's not even worth, you know, even having the conversations. Kind of knew at that point, like we had cash flow, we had a growing business and it's profitable. So there's no need to take on additional capital and just have the pain of having a VC on your board or on a cap table who's likely not aligned with where you are in the journey of building a business. And so that was just the decision. And you know, I talked to a lot of other entrepreneurs and friends of mine, CEOs and our board, and we kind of just decided, let's see how long we can go, continue to grow this thing. And look, we could always come back to the table and raise capital if we need it. But that day never came. So, and the same thing, I would say the same thing with remote, right? So I think, you know, in 2017, being a remote company was very contrarian. And, you know, I was shopping around the same time. I was like looking at an office space in Oakland and San Francisco. I'm like, okay, we need a foosball table and you know, the cool,
can't
like,
culture,
you know,
without a foosball table.
You need the painted mural, you know, to be able to attract talent and all this. Well, I'm hiring great talent remotely. Why don't we just see how long we could do this? And we're going to save so much money on those expenditures. And we're not going to be locked into like a 5-7, you know, 10-year lease. And so double down on remote. And then, you know, fast forward to 2020, everyone's remote. But at the time, it was a contrarian move. Same with the capital too.
I want to just double it click in for a second because, you know, the prevailing wisdom is you need to raise and, you know, most startups burn and then never get even close to the success that Dribble's achieved. Like what was it about either how you went to market or just the nature of your opportunity that made it so capital efficient?
The landscape has been shifting for a long time. And there are certain businesses that do need a lot of upfront capital to get off the ground and grow. You know, I think we see it today with like no code tools, and the world has become more remote and global. And so it's just easier to staff up and build a company, at least a software company today. But I remember a time when, you know, when I was first starting my career where, you know, we had to buy Sun Micro Machine servers and like, you know, those are $200,000 a piece and they had to go in the, you know, it's like the real expenses that you had to pay for even outside the people cost. And I think those expenses have just been pulled away with AWS and with all these new technologies that have opened up, just make it a lot more turnkey. And so, you know, there's a lot of startups, you know, in recent years, call it last like, you know, 5 years, who are raising money really just for acquisition costs and employees, attracting talent and then acquisition. And for us, we were finding great talent. We were lucky enough to have the way we were formed through Tiny. is that we had a Canadian entity and a US entity, which allowed us to staff in both countries. And, you know, as we grew, we hired more and more Canadian talent because the cost of living was lower. There's a 30% discount at the border. And so there was a lot of benefits to that and just the structure. And then we also just kind of made a rule of like, let's not hire in San Francisco, New York, where there's just a lot of competition and inflated salaries. And, you know, there's just great talent elsewhere. And so that was a strategic decision that pushed us away from like San Francisco, where I'm based, but also needing to raise money and to attract that talent in this like very competitive pool. And then on the acquisition side, the nature of the business is heavily SEO driven. And so my background is in marketing and growth and kind of exploring the different channels that we had at our disposal. And you paid was going to be really expensive. It had been inflating over the last, you know, those early years. And I knew that just wasn't a channel that for this type of product that we wanted to invest in. You know, you look at affiliate, look at, you know, a lot of those channels that require capital to invest in, either through like raw budget, but also like having to build a team to manage it. We decided to stay away from that and really focus in on channels that we owned and were free, right? And so that was SEO. There's an inherent correlation to the amount of UGC that's added to a platform that expands the number of pages that could be indexed by Google. There's a whole series of methodologies and just structured content that we leaned into in those early years. And then email was always a big channel for us, right? Another free channel for us where, you know, we leaned into user acquisition. So all of this traffic coming to the site, can we get them to sign up, get on our email list? And from there, we can kind of segment those folks. And then, you know, the other thing we've done is just like looking at how we make money. Like we have this like network at the foundation of the business, but we looked at, okay, we have all this traffic. Okay, so we have this subscription for designers that helps them, you know, enhance their profiles and you know, get more exposure on the platform. We have this hiring subscription for people looking to hire designers. We have an education business for folks who are up and coming designers. And then we have an advertising business just to monetize everyone else who's here, just window shopping, right? So we kind of like layered those on over the years, optimized, and then we could segment basically, you know, do our organic acquisition and then segment into, you know, those different product offerings.
As you described those offerings, LinkedIn came to mind. Are you basically LinkedIn for designers?
Yeah, I mean, that was definitely a big, they had laid this roadmap, like, okay, let's not reinvent the wheel. Like, what have they done that's been successful? We could probably do a lot of those things. We're at much smaller scale, right? But yeah, I think that was a big inspiration.
So tell us about the decision to step down.
So Dribbble acquired my former company, Creative Market, which is a YC company that I joined 11-12 years ago. And so it was just a really long run between the two businesses doing the same thing. You know, I'm still an owner in Dribbble. I'm the second largest shareholder behind Tiny. You know, I grew the business thinking one day there would be an exit. And at some point over the last year or so, I kind of realized it's probably not the strategy that Tiny is going to seriously explore unless there's a crazy outside offer. And so, you know, at that point, I think just for me personally, there's other things that I want to work on, other projects, other investors, investments. And so I just had like I love Dribbble. It's like a part of my DNA at this point of like who I am and like people know me as the Dribbble guy. And so it's a really hard decision. It's very bittersweet to make that call to step away. But, you know, the way I rationalized it too is like, hey, I was the guy to grow it to 50 million in revenue, but I'm probably not the guy to grow it to 100 million. And so let's go find that guy and I'll pass the baton. And that would also free me up to go work on some other things. So off the side of my desk, I am a real estate investor. I've done a few real estate projects, working on a big one right now. But also I'm at the stage of my career where I want to transition from being an operator to being an owner investor. And, you know, so I'll likely look at business to buy at this point going forward and take that route. So it's just kind of a career shift, a little bit of a midlife crisis, if I'm honest. But
convertible car outside and
not yet, no Porsche.
Okay,
yet.
Good.
But
no Porsche. Yeah. Okay. When I decided to shut down my investment bank to become a coach, it was a big decision, significantly aided by COVID. You know, in a 6-week period, we had hundreds of millions of dollars of deals die, and so it enabled a clean, you know, decision. But I approached that decision through two ways. One was my gut just knew. I would wake up in the morning and like, I know I want to become a coach. But I also then went and analyzed it. It was redundant, but, you know, I mind mapped the decision and thought it through in every possible vector and came to the same conclusion and then allowed my gut to be right. What was your process? Like, how did you arrive at this, which is, in fact, a bigger decision for you? You had more years. Like you said, you were the Dribble guy and, you know, bigger team. What was your process?
Not as sophisticated as a mind map. It was more of a kind of a, you know, I would say I probably had made the decision probably a year plus ago in my head. And then it was like, okay, how do I do this gracefully so I don't fuck things up? And so, you know, just doing the right, you know, bringing my board in and having an honest conversation. They had me lead the executive recruitment process to find my successor. And I, you know, I really put my heart into finding the right person to take over. And I want this company to continue to grow over the next 15 years. So that was just kind of really important to me, is just making sure that I did a graceful exit, because it is unusual, right? It's unusual to kind of leave when you're not at an exit. For me, is like, there may never be an exit. This may be a company that Tiny holds forever. And so at that point, like, there's only so many years and there's a lot of things I want to go work on. And so I have to find the time to go do that. And so this, there's a lot of, you know, risk to it. But I'm leaving, like, cash flow is really nice, right? Like, having that steady paycheck. But, you know, I think there's a quote, I forget who said it, but the three most addicted things in life are heroin, carbohydrates, and a steady paycheck.
Oh, that's a good quote.
And that was one of those things. I was like, you know what? I got to cut the cord and you know, at the end of the day, if I'm not working for an exit at a multiple return, then I'm really just a glorified employee. And what I need to be is an entrepreneur. And, you know, I've made a lot of guys rich, you know, over my career, not just at Dribble, but at my past startups. And, you know, I've spent a lot of time just thinking about, like, building wealth and, like, how many years do I have left in my career and on this planet, and the time that I want to spend and working, you know, a 9-to-5 job, even as a CEO, is, you know, as much as I loved building this business, where I am in my life and what I want next is really to spend more time with my family, to have freedom and flexibility over my schedule, to be able to, you know, do the things that I want to in life. I've decided, like, just pack up and hop on a plane and leave for 2 weeks. That's the freedom that I'm after. And I've made some investments along the way. I've been outside of Dribble. You know, given me a bit of a financial buffer. That's going to give me some freedom to go explore some different things. And some may work, some may not work. But, you know, I think at this point I'm unemployable. and so it's really just kind of all about entrepreneurship at this point and not looking back.
You know, I'm on a bit of a personal crusade to help make the startup CEO role more sustainable. Most of the time when CEOs come to me for coaching, it's because they're burnt out. They can't keep up with the growth of the company and they need help. And as a former banker, I can tell you the number one reason why CEOs sell is because they're burnt out. I'm curious whether, you know, because of the bootstrap nature of this role and maybe the more evergreen nature of A, the opportunity and B, Tiny's thinking, was this role maybe more sustainable than the standard burn your way to greatness kind of startup that you were probably exposed to in SF? Like, were you able to create space and boundaries for your different roles as, like, a husband, father, et cetera?
So even though I didn't have a VC on my board, like, you know, yelling at me to grow faster, I put that pressure on myself. So we did push hard, you know, have that sense of urgency always over, like, that, you know, seven, 8 year period. And that was kind of self-driven. And yeah, I mean, I just don't think we would have that success if I did operate it like maybe some of the other, you know, companies in the portfolio, which were just more dialed in for just cash flow, right? Like, just keep it cash flowing and not really focused on aggressive growth.
So you set the pace, you were comfortable with the boundaries, I guess is the the punchline.
Yeah. But the, you know, I think the burnout's real. I think I was burnt out at the end. So I think those years of just trying a lot of things and some of them working, some of them not working. And, you know, it's definitely a very complicated story of what happened internally with all the, you know, the different seasons and quarters and years along that journey. And in, I think COVID and the pandemic was also a piece of it. I think that was definitely like a hit to everyone's psychology. But, you know, coming out the other side of that was also, you know, again, this mindset shift of like, is this really what I want to spend the rest of my life doing? Or do I need to stop and take a look around and, you know, what else is out there?
Yep. Yeah. Right. You know, the saying, right? A change is as good as a break, but you never had a change, right? Some folks exit and then immediately go to the next thing, but you just kept going.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, that's hard. So I'm based in Canada. And Andrew's a pretty visible figure up here. And I'm, you know, you talked about an exit really not being in the horizon anytime soon. And I know Andrew's very inspired by Warren Buffett, who just buys and holds forever. And I'm just curious, what other lessons did you learn from Andrew that might be contrary to the standard kind of startup way of doing things?
Like Andrew's been a massive inspiration, again, especially coming from Silicon Valley, where, you know, I think every move he's made over the last, you know, 7-8 years has been very contrarian. And now, like, you know, it's become like, you see all these guys on Twitter starting holding companies and it's like the new thing. But, no, I mean, I think his ability to, I mean, part of this reason for me leaving is heavily inspired by him. He wrote a Medium article in 2016 or something around kind of defining like anti-goals. Like, here's the things I don't want to do in my life anymore. And, you know, and he's really like stayed true to that vision. And I think that was the goal of Tiny, was really just to give him the freedom to build the life that he wants to build. And so, yeah, it's been really cool to work with him over the years. You know, he's shared books with me that have opened my mind to just think differently about things. And then just working with him on deals, like Dribbble's done, you know, probably half dozen M&A transactions over the years. And, you know, working with Andrew and his team on those deals have really like taught me just a lot about negotiation and value investing and just thinking differently about just sensible, just business, right? Like it doesn't need to be that complex, right? Like you work with bankers and we do these like very like fancy like modeling and forecasts and you do all this stuff. And, you know, at the end of the day, it's much simpler of just looking at a business and like, okay, what's the right price to pay for this thing? And I think from that side of the room, I've learned a lot. And then from a distance, just kind of watching him, you know, in his public persona and kind of what he's doing there. I just think he's like, he's having a lot of fun and he's playing by his own rules. And I think that's, there's just a lot to respect there.
Yeah, no, there sure is. It's funny. I popped onto the Tiny site before we started this, just how do they position themselves? I hadn't looked at it in a while. And they even talk about being anti-synergy. Like, what acquirer is anti-synergy? But they're just like, no, just we're by you. You keep running it. Yeah, it's pretty fascinating. And yeah, very contrarian, that's for sure. You know, I'm curious, there's probably lots of CEOs listening who have maybe thought about, hey, what if I become a buyer? What if I start expanding the suite of what we're doing and move to the buy side? And I'm just curious, like, other than just practice and screwing up and getting better, like, how did you build that muscle? You know, how did you, what did you learn from Tiny and what did you just kind of figure out yourself to become a serial acquirer?
I mean, I think I knew nothing about M&A coming into Dribbble, and Tiny was buying businesses. And I was like, oh, well, they're going to do it. I could do it too. Like, so I started to reach out to folks and, you know, and a lot of stuff came in organically, and we started a bit of a search function internally too, where I had a corp dev person for a while, but I just kind of learned over time. But I think just being kind of naive in the beginning helped quite a bit of like, I'm not from the private equity world. I'm not from, you know, I'm a startup operator. And so moving into that, you know, capital management, capital allocation mindset in real time, like helped, you know, with a lot of these conversations. And I think also being the guy from Dribbble and talking to a lot of companies in our space and in our kind of outer circles, the doors are just immediately open and I could, you know, just easily get on the call with anyone and just have a conversation of like, does this make sense for you guys? And yeah, I mean, a lot of the deals that we did close, were like multi-year conversations, right? And I just, you know, those really just kind of relationship building and meeting founders of companies. And, you know, when it made sense, we made a deal. But we probably looked at hundreds of companies and you know, sent out a lot of offers that weren't accepted to get to those, you know, handful of deals that we did close.
Yeah, right. Value investing, that's another, you know, Warren Buffett pillar. Relies obviously on buying in, like buy low, sell high. And makes me wonder whether a lot of the companies that you ended up buying were either bootstrapped or lightly capitalized. Because of course, VCs by definition overpay. Otherwise, they end up acquiring massive stakes early on. And so they're shooting for these outlier exits, which probably don't fit value investing criteria. So did it turn out to be that way? Or did you end up buying VC-backed ones as well? And if so, were those distressed situations where they had to accept reality?
So I think the companies we did buy were that were VC-backed were distressed. And then we bought some non-distressed assets that were bootstrapped. And but the, you know, with all the assets, you know, we're going in thinking like, okay, we could probably grow these businesses. We can probably, and I think there are, you know, you do think of synergies, you know, as much as Tiny is very much has a very disciplined anti-synergy perspective. I didn't, you know, as CEO of Dribbble. So we were looking at like, okay, what are companies that we could bolt on, or we could integrate, or we bought like an iPhone app and a Android app that we reskinned, and those became the official Dribbble apps because it was cheaper to buy those than to hire developers and build those from scratch. And so those are kind of, you know, a very different strategy than a bolt-on or, you know, or some of these others. We bought Creative Market, which was VC backed. And, you know, that was a, you know, I think at the time it was, they either need to raise more money or unlock a lot of growth. And I think they were going to be challenged to do either of those moves independently. And so, you know, that was a deal that we bought the business. It was burning quite a bit of capital. But I knew the business, having worked there previously. And so I had, you know, a model in mind going into it of how I could turn the business around. And we took that business from burning, you know, $3 million the year before we acquired it to, you know, did like $7 million EBITDA last year. So, you know, that's a huge success story. And that one crew we bought and, you know, we paid a great price for it, but eventually we decided to shut it down because it just wasn't going to be something it requires a lot of investment to turn that business around. And we decided the risk was too high to make that investment.
Yeah. I mean, there's no official stats on this, but the prevailing wisdom is, you know, half of all acquisitions work out. It's just that the half that do work so well that it's worth taking the risk.
You know? Yeah. Structure is everything though. I think that, you know, when you buy asset, the heads you win, tails you don't lose so much is just really important as you structure deals.
Yep. That's right. Yeah. You don't want to go into it.
Especially as a bootstrapped company, right? Like so critical because there's not unlimited funds.
Yeah. I mean, so you brought up a really important concept that I don't know if enough CEOs appreciate and think of until they become growth stage, which is capital allocation, and that you are a capital allocator. Like, how did you think through, like, I've got this core business that I could continue feeding. How did you think through investing into that versus investing into, you know, a tangent or, you know, something different?
Yeah, you know, I think it's going back to when we're raising VC money, right? It was having a conversation of like, what would I even spend this money on? And so, you know, at some scale of growth, you know, you can take the profits in the business and reinvest in the business. If there's like R&D that makes sense, you see market that, you know, or there's a new line of business we want to build or incubate. We just didn't have that. Like we kind of had done all those things and had a good kind of like well-tuned machine. And a lot of the deals we did on the M&A side, I leveraged, you know, equity as much as possible to conserve capital. And so it was just kind of a conversation with the board over the years of, you know, do we take the cash and reinvest it in the company, or do we sweep the cash? And that's kind of Tiny's model, is to take the cash from their businesses and bring it up to the head office and then buy more businesses, right? They've done a great job with that. And so I think that's been a better model for them. And then, you know, I think we averaged, you know, a deal or so a year at the Dribbble level, which was, you know, really just from my mind, it was like, okay, we need growth, and let's look at both organic and inorganic levers that we can pull. And it was kind of a mixture of the two, you know, all along.
Yeah, that's another Warren Buffettism. It's why he owned insurance companies, because they spit all of this cash out that you can then use for other things. Right, until there's like a catastrophe and there's a bunch of claims. But until then, you got free cash, literally. Maybe switching gears for a second. So, you know, you were remote from day one by design. A lot of companies were forced to go remote during COVID, and a lot of CEOs equate culture with, like you said at the beginning, you know, foosball tables and being in the office. You know, what advice would you give CEOs, like, for really building companies remote without sacrificing culture?
So culture is it's a weird kind of buzzword, right? And I think it means different things to different organizations. And, you know, when I took over Dribbble, we defined a vision and a mission statement and a set of core values for the business. And, you know, really the heart of all that is that, you know, we wanted to build a business that provided a lot of value back to our community and to our customers. And we wanted, like, selfishly for me, and one of the reasons we went remote is I wanted to be, you know, close to my family. And, you know, I wanted to provide flexibility for myself, but also for my team. And also my personality. I've worked at, you know, large Fortune 500 companies where it's very political and very, like, you know, people stab your back when you're not looking, and just not a fun place to work. And I wanted to do the opposite of Dribbble. And so culture for me was like, I just wanted to be, have a fun place where we're spending most of our waking hours with these people, but we're doing it over Slack and Zoom. And so we did a lot of things to try to bring people together. We also did, you know, offsites where we got together in person also, you know, once a year or so. But no, I think it's been different at different stages of the business. And, you know, I think from my managerial style and the culture of the company has shifted as well, from, you know, really hiring lots of really great executives to own different parts of the business, to really having to pull back on the reins and owning that roadmap and strategy. So it's changed over the years, but, you know, I think the undercurrent is, you know, and I've said this to the team, like, the most important thing for my legacy and my tenure running this business is I want everyone who's worked at Dribbble to look back as, like, one of the best jobs they've had. And that's really just from building the culture on a foundation of trust. Like, there's not too much, you know, we're not monitoring people. We're not seeing who's online, who's not offline. We trust people to do good work, and they do, and look at it. And if they're not, then it's really easy to kind of see when they're not, and then we, you know, have to make adjustments as needed. But
maybe I know the answer to this because of the way you built the company, but do you think remote is just a better way to build?
I mean, it's definitely cheaper. So I think from that perspective, I think there's, you know, if you kind of study the evolution of even, like, the office spaces, right? Like, from cubicles to open spaces. But there's just a lot of inefficiency of having people have to commute from the suburbs into the city. And then you get in this open, you know, environment where people are shoulder tapping you, and there's lots of distraction and noise. And it's just not a very efficient place to work. Especially for, like, engineering and, like, deep thinking work. And so, allowing people to work from home or from a coffee shop or from a WeWork or whatever, definitely gives people a lot more focused time, undistracted time to get work done. You can argue that Slack is distracting, but, you know, we've also done things like, you know, no meeting Thursday to Fridays. We have no, like, random meetings today, or, like, you could turn Slack off. So experimenting with stuff like that, really just to kind of maximize the efficiency of output, which I think just a lot of people like. So I think from an IC perspective, I think if you did a survey, most people who are actually contributors will say they prefer remote work. And I think where you see a lot of pushback from remote work are the middle managers, where it's more of a theater. Their job is more of, like, being seen, like, you know, going from pod to pod. And
such a good analogy, theater. I love that.
So yeah, I mean, I think we'll see more and more of the world go remote in this industry, because the pandemic also opened up, you know, made hiring globally more of a norm, where even companies that were hybrid would still want people, like, locally, and, like, oh, you got to commute at least, like, a day or two into the office, whatever. You're still, like, nearby. But if you really embrace remote work, you can hire people from anywhere, and you might have some constraints like time zone that you're sensitive to. But, you know, for us, like, we hire across North America. We explore South America a little bit. There's like a language barrier that was always kind of prohibitive, but, you know, it really keeps your costs down because you don't have that rent and overhead. And then, you know, also like the salaries per headcount is lower than in these metropolitan super concentrated areas where, you know, you hire somebody, spend, you know, months in the recruitment process hiring somebody, they stay for 6 months and then go across the street and ask for a 10% raise.
So frustrating.
That environment's really hard to build a team, right?
Yep, 100%. You know, you brought up meetings. Did you find yourself moving towards being more asynchronous and kind of de-emphasizing meetings?
I think it's ebbed and flowed. We've gone through periods where, like, okay, we have too many recurring meetings. Let's just blow up the calendar. We've done rules where, like, okay, if there's no agenda and the calendar invite, you're okay to just like not show up. But, you know, it, at different stages of the business requires different structure and different kind of internal processes. When we acquired Creative Market, we brought that team into Dribbble, and we were one team, and with full time and contractors, we were like over 100 employees at one point. Last year, we spun out Creative Market as a separate company and hired a CEO to take over that business. And then Dribbble became really small again, right? We went from, you know, from 100 employees and the whole structure that goes with managing that many employees back down to 20. And so we changed the way we work and those processes. And so, you know, a business is this kind of living, breathing entity. And so there's no like hard rules that last forever. So we've always kind of stayed adaptive and flexible to, you know, changing the rules based on the needs of the business.
I love it. Yeah, it's super helpful. You know, all of my clients are remote today, but mostly forced. And so, yeah, this is just great to get your insights, having just done it from start to finish. As we start to wrap up here, I want to go back to why I reached out, which is when I read your post about meeting. And you walked us through it, but I just want to get into your head a little bit. You began that post with the sentence, "I quit my dream job today." So the day you left, you know, the day you weren't stepping in to, you know, checking in your Dribbble email, what was going through your head? What did you feel like?
So it was, you know, I still have access to my Dribbble email, so I'm still kind of, you know, in the company a little bit.
Good.
But no, it's definitely a surreal experience. I mean, that Monday, April 1st, I was the start date of, it was Constantine's first day on the job. And so I'm introducing the new CEO to the team. And I'm like, and today is my last day. And that was just like a weird
drop the mic.
It was kind of just a weird thing. I mean, they knew, the team knew for a week. So I was very transparent with everyone. But then that day was real, right? It was actually the day it was happening. And so that hit me. So it's definitely bittersweet. It was my dream job, right? So I knew Andrew online, you know, even back when he was making like Tumblr themes as a, you know, a teenage kid or however old he was. I don't even know how old he is, but, when I was at a company called Hired and was running growth at Hired, and Hired was in the same building as Uber and Square, but I was doing a rebrand for Hired, and I reached out to Metalab to submit an RFP, and like Andrew was still doing like all the sales for Metalab at the time. He was still CEO there. So we kind of reconnected and that didn't end up going with a different agency. But then like fast forward like 6 months or so, I get a text from Andrew. He's like, "Hey, I'm in the building. I'll run something by you." And I go down to the lobby. We grab a coffee, Tim and Chris, his partner. And he's like, "Hey, so I'm buying this company that's like perfect for your background. It's like part, you know, design, part recruitment. Like, I think you," and I was like, "Oh, it's Dribbble." He's like, "I can't tell you what it is. I'll send you an NDA tonight." and anyway, his EA at the time sent over the NDA, but in an email, the subject line said NDA for Dribbble acquisition.
Very discreet.
do I still need to sign this thing? But I call him the next day. I'm like, "I'm 100%, you know, and he hadn't even closed the deal yet. This is like October, and the deal didn't close until like early January or something. So, but that next day or that week or whatever, I resigned from Hired. I'm like, "You know what? I haven't received an offer from Andrew yet. He doesn't even own the company yet." But I'm like, "That is just what I'm going to go do. And that's my next journey." So it really was my dream job. I, at a previous company, just watching the birth of Dribbble was just this kind of amazing thing. Like, people were selling Dribbble invites on secondary markets. And I interviewed a designer for a company that I was at, and you know, basically asked the designer for invite to Dribbble because they're just so hard to get invites to at the time. So just, you know, I've been watching the company grow from the sidelines for years. And so just to have the opportunity to join the company in any role, let alone the CEO role, was definitely a dream. And it was a hell of a run. You know, we had a great time.
I'm really glad you shared that history. That just makes it really more special. I see you've got a mini Marshall stack, it looks like, behind you. So hopefully you've got some time to play some music.
Yeah. Do you play music as well? I see you got some toys behind you.
I run a record label. And it's a progressive house label called Deep Down. It's top 20 in the world in that genre. And so I release music myself pretty regularly.
Oh, awesome.
Well, Zach, thank you so much for making the time. I'm really excited for you. And I'm so glad I reached out because this is just a special moment. And I'm really glad that you're able to share that moment with everyone. Thank you so much.
Hey, thanks for listening to the Startup CEO Show. If you'd like to connect with me, be sure to visit my website at markmcleod.me or follow me on LinkedIn at @TheMarkMcLeod or Twitter at @MarkMcLeod_. And if you want to tune in again next week, be sure to subscribe on YouTube, Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'll see you next time.